You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 163.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. You have reached another Local Maximum, and this week, I'm just going to interrupt my marathon of interviews. I did like a ton of interviews that one week, remember? But hey, we need to do a March update. So I got Aaron on here. How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing well. Yeah, we got to squeeze it in before March is over.
Yeah, right. And it goes so fast with, I guess that's like one out of every four episodes, sometimes five, but usually four. So it's if I record five interviews, it's hard to fit it in there. I feel like I should have a math episode or something coming up. I know people like those. Although we do have a bunch of technical stuff today, so that'll be good. But first, did you happen to listen to the previous two interviews on the Local Maximum?
Yes, I did.
Great. All right. So, I thought it was really a lot of fun having Asif Lev on last week in particular. It was, you know, cool to hear from the actual CEO of Locals that we're on. And, I urge people to check that out. What do you think? Anything you took away from that?
It was interesting to get a little bit of a peek behind the curtain for where they were coming from and what direction they're heading in next. Those of our listeners who are on the Locals will have already seen that I poked you with a question because at the end he mentioned a feature they're working on, something that's going to be coming soon that a lot of people might be interested in. And it turns out that's something that you and I had talked about a week or two before that, completely independently. And so I had to get you to check my memory and say, did we talk about that after you did the interview or beforehand?
I was pleasantly surprised that like a lot of the product and tech discussions that are going on at a place like Locals are similar to what's going on in the industry. I guess that's not too surprising, but it's always different when you have kind of I hope it's not a bad term, but like a front man like Dave Rubin, where it kind of sounds like it's strange because Foursquare, you know, we had a product CEO in Dennis, when you have someone like Dave Rubin out there, it's sort of like, okay, well, where are the engineers? Where are the product thinkers? And I know that, you know, Dave Rubin's probably thinking a lot about the product too, but it's kind of cool that you have this guy, Asif, who's like, you know, thinking about Dave almost as the customer.
Yeah, I was going to say that there's a saying in tech that, you know, build the product that you would want to use. And that sounds like very much the direction that Rubin is coming from. And maybe he's less equipped to answer the question of, okay, so how do we build it? And that's why he's brought in, people on the technical side to support that side of the equation.
Yeah. Okay. What else did we do? Oh yeah. The episode 161.
Was that the tech censorship?
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. Yes. And that is with Sam. I forgot his last name. I'm sorry, Sam. Sam Jacobs. Yeah, that one was I actually, it sparked a whole bunch of conversation on Locals that I kind of have to dive into. Hopefully I will. Before this episode goes out, that was a little bit polarizing, like I thought it might be, but an important voice, an important point of view, I think.
Well, yeah, I remember again, peek behind the curtain here that we had some discussions about how do we present this, because there was some concern that it might be a little too controversial on some things. And
I've listened to his podcast Resistance Library, and it's actually quite good. Some of the history stuff is quite good, so I don't want to I don't want to present this as like, oh, is this crazy guy who came on the show no, he's actually very good, but personally I actually feel like I maybe need a little, I would need a little more convincing on like using government intervention to regulate tech companies into giving people free speech. I know we're going to talk about this a little later today, but that's something that he's very much against, or very much arguing against, but it's sort of something that I kind of have not, I'm not quite there yet, or, you know, I feel like I have some concerns, let's put it that way.
Yeah, it's definitely a fraught topic that causes some cognitive dissonance on my own side.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so we have a few topics today. First, we're going to talk about some of these non-fungible tokens. Are they a scam? And we're going to talk a little bit more about, you know, another article about reining in big tech. What a surprise. That's what the 160s are. The 160s have now become all about NFTs and, like, you know, how big tech has just become the evil machine. That's the whole thing. We're going to talk about not self-driving cars, flying cars. Holy crap. And then we'll end with causality. How's that sound?
We'll see if we can squeeze it all in.
Yeah, we'll see if we can squeeze it all in. Okay, so first of all, I want to point your attention to this this tweet. This is a rare good tweet storm by Jonty Waring. Not like that it's rare from him, but just rare in general. So I haven't heard of the tweeter, but he's in the UK with engineering experience, and he bothered to look into, you know, when you buy this digital art, these non-fungible tokens, as they call it, what are you actually buying? Now, I asked that question, you know, first. And so first it's like, hey, it's kind of like a certificate of authenticity. Like, I own the token from the original creator of that artwork, but I was concerned that, you know, you're going to have a hard time charging for that artwork because it's freely available online. So why would people pay you royalties? Although maybe there's a way to get that to work. This tweet, which I'll post on localmaxradio.com/163, shows something even worse about some of these, where some of this artwork that you're buying is, it's not like the actual, the bitmap for the artwork is on the blockchain. That would be very inefficient. It's usually some kind of hash. And so first of all, some of them refer to URLs. Now, that's very bad. Aaron, can you tell me why that's really bad? Sorry to put you on the spot.
I'm assuming that it has something to do with have you ever gotten a 404? You know, have you ever tried to go to a URL and it is broken because something that was once there no longer is?
Right, right. And that actually happens all the time. Have you ever heard of the $1 million web page? This just came out. This just came in my mind. $1 million page. So this is actually something that was done. This is something from our generation. It was done in, like, I don't know, 2004 or 2005 by someone who had just graduated college. And he was like, I'm going to buy a web page. I have 1,000 pixels by 1,000 pixels.
Oh, I do remember hearing about this.
Basically, every pixel is going to be sold for $1, and I'm going to make $1 million. And he sold it out. And by the way, when you buy a pixel, you could color it, and you could send it to a URL. You could send it somewhere else on the internet. Now, the interesting thing that nowadays, so the website is still up. You know, he promised them it'll be up forever. But a lot of these websites no longer exist. So if you click around on $1 million page, I mean, let's see, million.
Oh, I see. Each pixel is also a link to something.
Right, right, right. So if you go, oh, it's milliondollarhomepage.com. Okay, I could see the pic. First of all, a lot of these, a lot of this artwork looks very like early 2000s, which is pretty interesting. So let's say, here's one. Increase your sales today. Silver member is free. Okay, I'm going to click it. Site cannot be reached. You know, what a surprise. So most of these do not exist anymore, which is pretty interesting. I mean, fortunately, that guy made $1 million off of it. But it goes to show. Now, fortunately, you know, the Foursquare URLs are all there from 11 years ago. But it just goes to show that a lot of URLs, they're not permanent. So watch out for that. Now, Some of them refer to something called, they don't refer to URLs, they refer to IPFS. That's actually the better way to do that. It has this crazy name, IPFS. It's called the Interplanetary File System. I don't know why it's called interplanetary. Like, I don't know if there's another planet involved, but have you heard of this, Aaron?
I've heard that name before, but I did not recognize the acronym when we were talking about this previously.
So it uses something called content addressing. So that means that every file that you have can be put through, think of it like a machine, like a function, that it takes all the data from that file and boils it down to like a shorter string, maybe not that short, but like that boils it down to like a string that you could put in the URL bar that would be a bunch of letters, numbers, and symbols, and or whatever that you wouldn't make heads of tails of. But each file that could exist has a more or less unique string because it's in cryptographic hash. Obviously, you might be like, well, how could every single possible file, even like the ones that are almost infinite in size or like huge in size, have the same hash? Well, there are collisions, but the idea is, you know, the resulting string is long enough that there won't be collisions for quadrillions of years. So
when you initially said that it was going to shorten the URL, I was thinking like a bit.ly link, but there's a lot more going on under the hood here, it sounds like.
Right. So if you want to take an image and shorten the URL essentially using this content addressing scheme, and then you do it again with the same image, then you get the same string back. If you take that image and you change a single pixel and you put it through content addressing, you get a completely different address. So
it's not dissimilar to a CRC.
CRC. That's one you're going to have to explain to me.
Oh gosh, you're putting me on the spot. I don't remember what the acronym stands for, but basically I know at least one place it's used is in Ethernet frames. I'm sure it's used in a lot of other places, but it's a way of having a short sequence of bits that the content of the message can be compressed. You know, it goes into a function and it puts out this short sequence. And if that short sequence doesn't match the content, then you know that something has become corrupted. And like you were saying before, there's some collision space. You could have more than one input that generates the same output. But it's very unlikely that if you have, for example, a bit flip or, you know, one or two minor changes, that it will generate the same exact output. So it's an error detection scheme.
Right, right. So a bunch of systems use IPFS. There is a cryptocurrency called Filecoin, of which I own a small investment. And this is a cryptocurrency where actually you could use Filecoin to pay the blockchain, pay the miners to or the people who run nodes for that blockchain to store files for a specified period of time. So I could be like, I have a file, I want you to host this for 100 years. I pay you in Filecoin, and then it happens. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And they use IPFS to host those files. So anyone could use IPFS. It's open, right? Because it makes sense. Like, you could host anything. If an image is hosted on there's only one place it could be hosted, and there's just no guarantee that it will be hosted, if that makes sense. Like, if I take a picture of myself, it's not hosted on IPFS, but so I have to host it, but only that picture could be hosted at that address. It's almost like every possible picture you could take of yourself is already has an address. Every photo you could take with your iPhone already has an address in IPFS waiting to be used for it, which is
so. If I have two copies of this photo that are stored in two different places on the internet, would the IPFS would point to both of those, or would it?
Oh no! So IPFS would take the, IPFS wouldn't point to a place on the internet. It would just basically you would call that. You know, you would call the photo's hash on IPFS and the photo would come out if it's hosted. And then the person hosting it can prove, hey, this photo gets stamped down to this hash. So I can prove to you that, yes, this photo is what's here.
So you can retrieve the real photo, but it could be in multiple places simultaneously.
Oh, sure. You could have multiple people hosting same file in IPFS. Yeah. So, okay. IPFS seems like it's a better way to store these pieces of digital art. But, you know, so there are now a few pitfalls. First of all, you want to make sure that the IPFS file that stores your digital art is not itself a URL. Like, it'd be like, here's the IPFS, and then you go there and it says, it's actually not an image, it's just a URL to somewhere else. So you're at the original problem. Secondly, it does not guarantee, you know, that anyone is hosting it there. So if you own this digital art, you should also keep a copy of it in case, you know, nobody else hosts it or nobody else copies it. So there's one problem of anyone could copy it, but then there's another problem of, you know, there's no guarantee anyone will copy it or host it. So if you own the artwork, you better control several copies of it, because it's basically like, you know, what if you have the certificate of authenticity for a painting and then you lose the painting? It's no good. Likewise, if you lose the certificate of authenticity, it's no good.
Makes me think of the Internet Archive, that maybe you should make sure that there's a copy of it there, since they seem to be somewhat reliable.
Yeah. But even them is, you know, yeah, it's not, there's not no guarantee they'll be around.
I see a lot of parallels here to gold, in that, you know, the most secure way of possessing gold is to literally have the gold bars in your, you know, in your own home, in your own safe. And then a step down from that would be you have your gold bars in somebody else's safe, you know, at a safe deposit box, the bank. And then there's another step away, which is I have a slip of paper that says that it's redeemable for gold bars.
Right.
And then you could take another step, which says I'm invested in a fund which supposedly owns some gold bars. And you take enough steps away and it becomes much easier for someone to in the intervening chain to go bankrupt. And all of a sudden you have a worthless piece of paper.
It's the same thing with cryptocurrencies, too.
Yes, and I suppose. Yeah.
By the way, it's not, you know, there are people who say you have to own gold in your safe, or you have to control your own private keys in cryptocurrencies. There are also reasons not to. And actually, I'm going to talk about that with a future guest, which I'm going to spoil now. It's Peter McCormick of the What Bitcoin Did podcast in a upcoming episode. But in this case, with digital art, it costs you almost nothing to keep a copy of the digital art, even if somebody else is also, also has it. So it's a little bit different from gold.
The big advantage to digital art is that it almost counter to the fact that we're referring to it as non-fungible. You can have multiple copies of it stored in multiple places, and it does not decrease the security. It's not like you have to split your hoard of gold between multiple storage locations. You can have, in this metaphor, the same bar of gold in multiple different places without having to give anything up there.
Yeah. Yes. The art itself, the file itself. Now, the private key that you have that proves that you own the art, that's another question, because if somebody else has that, then they could take your NFTs. So
sure, yeah.
So that comes back to, how do you store your cryptocurrency with NFTs? It's the same thing.
There's always a bottleneck somewhere.
Yeah. All right. So I hope that makes sense to people. Next one is, this is an article that you sent me. We've already talked a lot about so-called big tech. I don't know which one this is talking about. Oh, yeah. Twitter, Facebook, Google, YouTube. All the usual suspects. The last two episodes have been about taking on big tech, actually, so it's not surprising that we're still talking about it. So this article that you sent me is interesting. Well, tell me a little bit about it. It's interesting because it harkens back to something that I talked about in episode 9, and you recognize that, which I'm very impressed.
Yeah. So I was reading through this, and actually, funnily enough...
So what's it called?
So I received this in a publication called, I believe it's pronounced Imprimis, from Hillsdale College, which don't ask me how I ended up on their mailing list, but I did. And it's not just a mailing list. I received a physical copy of this newsletter. So I was actually reading this on a glossy piece of paper. And it was, I think, literally the last paragraph or two the general discussion was, you know, something needs to be done. Big tech is becoming too powerful. You know, they have control of the modern town square. And so we can't just write it off as, well, they're private companies. They can do private company stuff and we can't stop
them. We've heard it. It's called Who's in Control? The Need to Rein in Big Tech.
Right? Yeah, but when it got to the very end, one of the conclusions that the author drew or possible solutions that he proposed was very reminiscent of something that you had discussed in a much earlier episode. And so I thought, oh, this it almost sounds like he listened to an episode of your podcast and took the words right out of your mouth.
Where are my royalties? We don't have the NFT. See, that's why. So, all right. Why don't you read the key quote there?
Sure. Yeah. So it's our ultimate goal should be a marketplace in which third-party companies would be free to design filters that could be plugged into services like Twitter, Facebook, Google, and YouTube. In other words, we would have two separate categories of companies, those that host content and those that create filters to sort through that content. In a marketplace like that, users would have the maximum level of choice in determining their online experiences. At the same time, big tech would lose its power to manipulate our thoughts and behavior and to ban legal content, which is just more extreme, which is just a more extreme form of filtering from the web.
Right. Okay. So essentially it would be like, yeah, if you are one of these platforms, your only goal should be to sift through legal and illegal content, not to be censoring the legal content, which is sort of what Locals does and leaves the filtering of the legal content, which you have to do because, you know, just having all the content together leads to a lot of crap, which we see on Twitter. It's amazing as much as they censor and filter and remove and shadow ban, most of the comments are still just very low calorie or high. Wait, no, high calorie, empty calorie. That's what I want to say.
Low nutritional value.
Yes, yes, yes. Low information content, or perhaps negative information content. That was sort of my idea, and I was like, in 2008, I said, hey, look, if you want to subscribe to like the New York Times filter, you could do that. Maybe it'll be run by the New York Times and I have a good idea of what I'm going to get from that. Or I can maybe go to a filter that's maybe a little too permissive and I get kind of everything. Or maybe I just, you know, I find some other group that seems to be really good at it and seems to like, promote the things that sort of make me think or catch my interest. And then I'll do that one. And so, yeah, there could be sort of a competition among the filterers, and then they're kind of federated, you know, compete, and maybe each filter company can work across every service. You know, if I'm a filter company, maybe I'll make one for Twitter, I'll make one for Facebook, I'll make one for Google, et cetera, or for YouTube, et cetera, you know? And so, that competition would give people choice. I think it's a very interesting idea. And it's sort of, I mean, you know, perhaps it could be implemented on something like Mastodon, I'm not sure. I think that would make a lot happier.
I can't remember if I mentioned this way back in episode 9, but it makes me think of Slashdot, which I haven't been on there in years. But
me neither.
They used to have a feature where, you know, there's the standard feed, but you can flip a little switch and it turns on the fire hose, which is basically the unfiltered feed. So you get to see things that, you know, haven't been moderated and haven't met a threshold for, you know, a certain number of upvotes, and, you know, You can opt into that, and that's a simplified version, I think, of the kind of concept you're talking about here. That you wouldn't want the choice necessarily to be a binary, you know, our filtered feed or no filter. But the ability to turn off the filter means that you could, in theory, then apply an alternate filter onto it.
Right, right. There's this other quote here. Even more troubling, I think, this is now quoting from the article, are the invisible thing that these companies do. Consider quality ratings. Every big tech platform has some version of this, though some of them use different names. And I thought, yes, I've worked on a quality rating at Foursquare. I've actually worked on a few of them for Foursquare tips and reviews. But fortunately, as I've said, you know, in previous episodes, the Foursquare data set is not as contentious. You know, there's just a lot of just kind of useless reviews there. I mean, you know, we filter out people who look like they were banging on the keyboard, and people who just say things that don't make any sense, and things like the spam, you know, people saying, call this number. But even in Foursquare tips, like we've had discussions about this back in the day when we were focusing on the consumer product, that it was like, yeah, there are definite areas of gray area and disagreement as to what makes a good tip. And then, so, of course, venue quality too, like, you know, rating the actual places was another interesting one.
I don't want to dig too deep into the Foursquare algorithm here, but do these quality ratings, do they apply in a what's the proper term here? An individual manner to each review? Independent, that's what I'm looking for, an independent manner? Or do you build a profile of a user and you identify, oh, this user is a low quality user, and so we're going to discount their reviews because they have a history of not providing useful information?
So we do take the author into account, but I don't think that it is... I don't think it's going to do what you say like that.
Not as harsh as I stated it.
Yeah, exactly. So you take into account, for example, the language that the user tends to speak or to type in. So that's one. You want to show people things in their own language first.
Okay. Yeah, I know you've talked about the language model on a couple of episodes before.
Yeah. And do we know if a user is low quality? I don't remember, but I'm pretty sure each tip gets its own unique rating. And then maybe a user can have a sort of a slight bump, if I remember correctly, or it's possible not. But I'm pretty sure the quality score of the tip is the main thing. And I think that the user is either not taken into account or barely taken into account. But then again, this was a different time. This was back when we could sit down and be like, okay, what are our users looking for? They want to know, you know, they want good reviews, as in accurate reviews. They want like cool things to do, like fun things to do at a place, like things to order, or if you're at a park, like what should you check out? Or if you're at a museum, you know, what exhibit should I check out? And so it was like, yeah, that's what our users want. They want something in their own language. They want something that is not like completely broken English so you can't understand it. You know, they want it reasonably well written, but maybe not too well written, so it's like too long. You know, so it's like, okay, these are what our users want, and this is how we're going to filter for it. Another one is like recency, you know, things, you know, created more recently matter as well. So there was gray area, there was area of disagreement, but it was apolitical.
Hmm.
Whereas all of these, and what does apolitical really mean? I'm not really sure, but I feel like there's a different thing today where it's like, it's not the product team's, it's not in the hands of the product team. It's not in the hands of the engineers, the product managers, the designers, and all of those people. It's like, it's more in the hands of like the trust and safety commission and the lawyers and things like that of these companies and the PR of these companies rather than the people who care more about the product. That's what I mean.
Well, I'm sure that there's a long conversation that we could dive into off of that, but not today.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've been complaining about this for a long time. I mean, it could be... The tech industry just went down the path of ad-supported large social networks, and that worked for a certain period of time, grew to a very large size, and now that business model has kind of run its course, and now as these companies optimize their profits more and more, it's sort of it's sort of decreasing their effectiveness more and more, and we're sort of ready for the paradigm shift, as I've been talking about for a long time. So that's just another way to look at what we've already been talking about. So yeah, okay, I'll finish on that note. All right, so this next article, I was like, no way this could be real. Because when I moved to New Hampshire, we did episode 158 entitled Live Free or Die when I moved here to New Hampshire. And I was like, yeah, everything's legal here in New Hampshire. But I didn't know that this was legal. In June of last year, New Hampshire became the first state to legalize flying cars on the road. So we now have flying cars in New Hampshire. Now, before I started getting excited, I'm like, oh man, I haven't seen one yet. So they don't really exist. That's why. But they are legal if you get your hands on one. Now the law called it's called the Jetsons Bill. I guess it's called the Jetsons Law. This is the lame part of the law. You're not allowed to take off on the road. You actually have to drive to the airport to take off. But I have a feeling that some people will break the law in some of those long, flat roads up in the country.
Well, it depends on how you define airport, because there are, even in Massachusetts, there are a number of improvised runways that meet some sort of requirement for being a runway that are definitely not, you know, tower operated.
Right. So these are essentially small airplanes that you could drive on the roads, right? I mean, like, so you can't drive an airplane on the road, right? So how they...
Not easily, yeah. So
if you want to get an airplane from one airport to a nearby airport, you literally have to fly it.
Right. And part of the I guess the opposite of a value proposition of owning a small private airplane is that, okay, yes, it can make travel from point A to point B, where point A and point B are two airports, a lot faster, because you can, you know, go as the crow flies, and you can go at, you know, for general aviation, you know, small engine aircraft, you're generally looking at upwards of 100 miles an hour. So between those two things, you can go a lot faster than if you were to do that same drive in an automobile. The problem is, though, now you're at an airport in a new region, new location, and unless the place you want to go is the you know, rinky-dink burger joint at the airport, now you need to get a car. And,
right.
And that's got some hassles with it. You know, either you got to rent a car, or you need to have a friend to come pick you up, or you need to keep multiple cars at airports across the country, at which point, why are you flying your own airplane? So it comes with some challenges to make it a practical method of getting around. And this, in theory, would bridge some of that gap, because you can drive from your garage to the airport, take off, land at another airport, and then drive to, you know, the place where you're having a meeting, or to the rental house that you're staying at for your vacation or whatnot. So that was the concept there. And this is not something new. You know, this is an idea that's been kicking around for almost as long as airplanes have been a thing.
Yeah.
But as they pointed out in at least one of the articles that we talked about, there's kind of requirements pulling in opposite directions for what makes a safe vehicle on the road and what makes a safe vehicle in the air.
All those people on the road in Massachusetts, do you trust them in the sky? I don't even trust them on the roads.
Well, at this point, one of these flying cars would require a pilot's license anyway. Ostensibly, you wouldn't have any less trust in these people than you would in the people who are already flying around in the air.
Come on, live free or die.
What would worry me if I owned one of these is some crazy person dinging my car, you're getting me in a fender bender. And it's bad enough when it's my, I don't know, my $30,000, regular medium nice car. It's another thing when it's my $300,000 aircraft, and now that you've dinged it, I don't know if it can fly again, and so I'm gonna have to bring it in for an inspection that, you know, may involve tens of thousands of dollars of repair to
like
get it back to being safe and airworthy. So that's one of the biggest hassles, is not just being safe on the road for you, but
you're probably
being
not gonna
enough.
You're probably not gonna parallel park it in the city.
Yeah, that's going to be something you're going to want in a garage.
Yeah. You can afford the flying car, you can afford the garage. So there's a company that's actually working on these, right? It's called, what's it called? It's called, we had it written down here.
So there are a couple of them. There's Terrafugia, right. Which is based out of Massachusetts. They got bought out or acquired by a Chinese company a few years back. And it sounds like they're making a pivot away from this space, that they have a prototype in the self-driving car market space, but it sounds like they're pivoting towards more the urban air mobility market. But there's a company out of the Netherlands, and I think a company out of either Washington or Oregon who's doing stuff in the similar flying car space.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting to think about, but I don't think we're going to see people flying their cars anytime soon. Probably not until long after they're self-driving their cars, which we'll talk about in a minute.
I think the air taxi urban air mobility thing is much more likely to catch on in a big way before we start seeing a significant number of flying cars that are consumer owned.
So you're saying they might be like air taxis or something like that.
Yeah, I don't think we're gonna see the kind of adoption pattern that we saw with like Tesla and electric cars happening with flying cars anytime soon.
Yeah. What's scarier, a flying car driving past or a driverless car driving past? What would make you more nervous?
Well, the big next step once they get these air taxis approved, which do vertical takeoff and landing, is there are at least a couple of companies that are designing them that they're not even building them with plans for a pilot.
So are these
self-flying?
So are these kind of like helicopters then, or something else?
There's a lot of tilt rotor design involved in it, but the design intention is that these are going to be vertical takeoff and landing, so you don't have to have a long runway.
A helicopter.
In that sense, yeah, it doesn't have the one giant rotor that a helicopter has. It's going to have a lot. They generally have multiple small rotors.
Oh, okay, I see.
But the kind of the flight profile is much more similar to that, and some of them actually have rotating engines so that they can take off like a helicopter and then transition to flying like a regular aircraft.
I see. Okay, cool. Anything else on this before we moved on? This is our first flying car episode. So that's exciting. Now, this is not, sometimes this thing comes up in the news. It's come up in the news, years ago, but I don't know. I was just like, this one hit close to home, and I was like, whoa.
Yeah, I think the way to view this is that it's not dissimilar to what we've seen in some of the Western states where they've created special zones and special rules and laws that allow or encourage the self-driving car development work to be done there. So by New Hampshire passing this law, it opens the window to make this a more viable product for the people who are willing to invest in it.
Gotcha.
And we'll see where that goes. That maybe they'll be the first of many, or maybe this will remain a weird thing that just New Hampshire does.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So finally, I'm also going to, so all the articles will be linked on the show notes page, localmaxradio.com/163. The final one is, I'm going to link to, this is a pretty good, actually a very good article on an academic paper. And so I thought the article did a very good job of kind of explaining this. This is from Tech Talks, Why Machine Learning Struggles with Causality by Ben Dixon, March 15th, 2021. And, I've talked about causality on the show before. I've worked on causal models. The last one I talked about it was in episode 31 with Shirin Mojarad she was doing causality on products for education. Do these things cause learning? And I'm doing it for ads. Do these things cause buying or in my case, going to a place? So when it comes to these more complicated AI models, causality is actually, it causes a big problem for them. And it is, it's sort of where they fall short now, even on the deep learning models. So if I could just quote for, and it's something that is very much needed to get a grasp on for something like self-driving cars, where the car needs to know, well, if I do this, then X, Y, and Z will happen because this is how physics works. Or, you know, this animal or this person or this vehicle in front of me will respond this way if I do that. Or they'll respond this other way if this other vehicle does something. So it's sort of like, it's sort of important to make sure that it knows all that. Because if it doesn't, if it's just kind of a series of instructions, even if it knows these, has learned these instructions from millions and millions of examples, you know, having these causal models in its model, I guess, having these causality results in its model will allow it to navigate through these kind of one-off situations a lot better. And when it comes to driving or anything in real life, all situations are essentially one-off. You've never been in the same exact situation twice, only similar situations. Yeah, so let me just read a few things. Lack of causal understanding makes it very hard to make predictions and deal with novel situations. It's very good to like suss out the exceptions to the rule, because you know machine learning models are very good at coming up with the rules, but then it's like, you know, it's not always very good at coming up with finding like what are the rare exceptions. But if you know how the universe works, it's easy to figure out that exception. I'm sort of like, you know, trying to figure out an example. It's like, well, objects fall, but if it's a bird, it's probably not just going to fall the same way as a tennis ball does, you know, for example. Okay, it when I first read it, it reminded me of Judea Pearl's work, The Book of Why on Causal Language, which I read. And it says here in the article, the paper contains references to the works done by Judea Pearl, a Turing Award-winning scientist best known for his work on causal inference. Pearl is a vocal critic of pure deep learning methods. Meanwhile, Yoshua Bengio, one of the co-authors of the paper and another Turing Award winner, is one of the pioneers of deep learning. You need less examples when AI has an effective understanding of causality. And the simple example they give in the article is, you know, they're building the models that first attempt to identify the causal structure. And then, or my simple explanation actually is like, so when I was doing something like attribution, or when you're doing experiments, you already have the causality in mind. Like mine was ads cause buying, or smoking causes cancer, et cetera, right? But when it comes to these large AI models, you don't know what causes what. So it's like your hypotheses are, your hypothesis space in the Bayesian sense is, you know, what causes what, and you're trying to figure that out. So it's sort of, it builds these causal models first, then it sort of tries to factor them out. You know, okay, if I know what causes what, then I could kind of factor that out in my training set. And then I could sort of, if I know gravity causes falling, then I could kind of look at what are the exceptions of that and try to learn that. But if I don't know that, then I'm kind of all over the place. So I know it's maybe wishy-washy. We don't have that much time, but that is a very active area of research in machine learning that is going on. And so that's sort of an area that you know, when someone talks about like deep learning, deep AI, it's often important to talk about, you know, where does causality fit into this. Let me see if I get the name of the paper before we head out. So the paper is called go ahead.
I was just gonna say, while you're looking for that, What's the takeaway we can put into practice here? Is it that we should be more skeptical of when they talk about using AI and machine learning? Is there something that we can put into practice about causality in our daily lives here, or is this just a thing to watch.
I think it's, well, it is a thing to watch, but I think beyond that, I think that there's a connection between causality and intelligence and human intelligence that we should not take for granted. And so it's something that right now machines are still very bad at. They're going to get better in the future. And so what does that mean? Does that mean that we then approach human level intelligence, which we don't yet have? But it's definitely so for those of you who are like, you know, engineers and who study this stuff, it's definitely, you know, an active area of research. For some of you who would just like to follow the tech news, which is probably most of you on this, who are listening to the show, it's sort of something to ask yourself when you're reading these articles, and to sort of think about, you know, hey, when it comes to my Google Photos making a mistake, or when it comes to self-driving cars making a mistake, it's probably something it's probably a causal deficiency. We'll put it that way.
So that makes me very curious to see that, because humans, we absolutely have areas where our causal intuition, our causal reasoning falls apart.
And yes, but we're very good at it.
I wonder how
machines.
Much as artificial intelligence develops a better understanding of causality, will they adopt our same contours there, or will they have a distinct areas at which they are better at determining causality than we are, and areas at which they are inferior to human intuition there?
That's very interesting. So we have our visual cortex is very complex. We have a very innate handle on causality when it comes to like physics here on Earth and images.
The classic,
and,
you know, throwing and catching a ball. That we don't do math to do that. But we have a, you know, we build intuitive models based on our observations that allow us to complete the equation there.
Right, but one area of research of application for this, where humans maybe are not so good, or the more kind of scientific, kind of either the pure sciences, or I could think of the medical sciences, where you get into something like physics, where something like relativity, quantum physics, really theoretical physics, where, you know, we don't know exactly how causality works on a small scale, or something like medicine, where we have experiments that are pretty decent, but, you know, we're still kind of shooting in the dark over exactly what causes what.
Right. I mean, there's the classic, you know, correlation is not causation. We sometimes struggle to separate the wheat from the chaff there.
Yeah. So this article says that during the coronavirus pandemic, many machine learning systems began to fail because they'd been trained on statistical regularities instead of causal relations. And as life patterns changed, the accuracy of the model dropped. So, you know, measuring, okay, if the virus comes into a particular area, how do the people react? You know, which is very hard for a mathematical model.
That absolutely makes sense. That's a classic. You know, we have somewhat a brittle model, and you know, if you change things
more
a little bit,
causality.
It can adapt to that. But if you have a dramatic change, like all of a sudden everybody's in lockdown, it's not moving the goalposts, but it's redefining the scenario so dramatically that previous assumptions aren't going to hold up necessarily.
As I read this, though, I think that's not just a causality problem. It's also a complex systems problem where you're talking about human response, which is, and each person is unimaginably complex. And then you have the groups of people, which are even more complex than that. So I think it's not just the causality that are causing these models to get wrong, but it's an interesting example. Let me see.
Did you find the name of the paper?
No, I had it up just a second ago, which I'm like, how come You know, it should have, it should have been pretty simple.
We can put it in post.
Oh, here it is. Here it is. Okay. It's called towards causal representation learning. Yeah. So it's basically the idea is first you figure out what the causal model looks like, what causes what, and then you train the model in terms of like, well, how do they cause the different, how does A cause B? First, the question is, does A cause B, or does B cause A, or does C cause A, which then causes B? So first you figure that stuff out, and then you train what those variables do to the different other variables. So can you use that in life? I mean, I feel like maybe you can.
We can try.
Yeah. All right. We'll try to look for a specific example, you know, as we use Bayesian inference and machine learning examples in different news stories. Maybe we'll try to come up with next time we'll try to figure out what our potential causal models might look like. That might be an interesting exercise.
Very good.
All right. Cool. I think we're ready to call it a day.
Sounds good.
That was our March news update. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. To support the Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week. Feel the power.